All right, Deck Brewers, welcome back to episode 2 of Deck Design MTG Podcast. It's Big Mike here. I'm ready to go over what we brewed last Thursday and to give you a little bit of a spoiler about what we're going to do this Thursday. For any of you that are new to the channel, welcome, and my name is Mike. My show is called Deck Design MTG. We are on twitch.tv/deckdesignmtg every Thursday night, 7 to 9. Eastern Standard Time. It's an international interactive deck brewing show where we pick a commander throughout the beginning of the week and then we spend an hour and a half-ish about brewing them. And we spend another half hour in the beginning of the show going over kind of the tactic that we're going to use to brew said commander. Last week, we brewed a sweet Landfall Yarrick deck and it was awesome. So, we're going to go over that today. We're going to talk about why we put some stuff in there. What are the key points? What are the key hinge things that we really want to capitalize on as we build this thing out? And then I'll give you a little sneak peek as to what we're going to do Thursday. Fun fact, we're starting our color wheel challenge and we're starting with red. All right, so Yarrick, let's get into Yarrick here. So Yarrick the Desecrated is going to be our commander. He is a 2-mana Sultai, black, green, blue. He's got Death Touch and Life Link. He's a 3/5. And if a permanent entering the battlefield causes a triggered ability of a permanent you control to trigger, that ability triggers an additional time. Yarrick is a Panharmonicon on a creature. That's literally it. That's all you need to know. Him on the face alone, it's just a 3/5 body with a really fancy effect. But if you pair him with just about anything that's got a powerful ETB, you have an extreme value engine brew coming into your house. So that's what we did. I reached out into Reddit. I reached out on the Facebook. We went over a couple of the different mechanics that were out and about just to kind of figure out what mechanic we really wanted to focus on. And Landfall was kind of the winner on that one. So that's what we did. We brewed a Yarrick Landfall deck. So if we go through the deck list is on moxfield.com. The deck is called Yarrick Land Explosions. You can search it right in the top bar. We put a lot of different things in there. So let's start out with a couple of the Landfall creatures here. Naturally, whenever you build a Landfall deck, you want to put Avenger of Zendikar in there. It's just a shoe-in card for just about any Landfall deck. That is because at a certain point, you can get enough plant tokens to basically overrun the whole battlefield and call it a day. So, Avenger of Zendikar is 5 green-green. It is a 5/5 creature and says whenever he enters the battlefield, create a 0/1 green plant creature token for each land you control. Whenever a land enters the battlefield under your control, you can put a +1/+1 counter on each plant you control. So, if you have 10 lands on the battlefield, throw Avenger down. You're going to get 10 0/1 plants. Play your land for the turn. They get a counter. Maybe it's a fetch land. Crack it. Go get another land. They're going to get another counter. And then you just kind of roll your mana base out and your plants get huge. And that's that. Swing for the wins, right? So Avenger was a shoe-in in this build. And I advise anybody to really make sure that he's in there. It works really well with just about any deck that is running big land and has kind of land interactions. So, Avenger, definitely. We put Azusa in there. Azusa is a creature that enables you to play 2 extra lands on your turn. She is 2 and a green on a 1/2 body. She's a human monk. You play 2 additional lands on each of your turns. That's it. So, if you get Avenger of Zendikar, and then you can play 3 fetches and then crack them and then get 3 lands out on the battlefield. Well, your plants get 6 +1/+1 counters on it. It's a huge effect. It's very beneficial. It honestly can't get a whole lot better than Azusa in terms of how to get extra lands out there. We do run extra land effects. So we do have things out there like Exploration, which enable you to play an extra land on the turn. Stacked with Azusa and everything else. We also, this deck specifically, we kind of engineered it so that when your lands enter the graveyard, you could play them out of the graveyard or get a mass of lands to come out. We are running Scapeshift in this deck as well. Scapeshift's in there just to kind of trigger your landfall ability as many times. Basically, your power out turn. Your winning turn, you don't want to kind of have anything counter, do anything like that. This is the big power play. You play your Scapeshift, you sack a whole bunch of lands, and then you get a whole bunch of lands. You trigger your landfall creatures 10, maybe 12 times. It's going to double with Yarik on the board. It just gets gross. Gets gross really quickly. So, we do have a couple mana dorks in here. So we run a Birds of Paradise and a Land of War Elves. For landfall creatures, we do have Obnixilus the Fallen, Rampaging Baelos. We have a Royal Elemental. Royal Elemental is actually one that I didn't originally think of because it's a different play style than what I'm used to. Royal Elemental is landfall. Let me read the card. So it's 3 blue, blue, blue. It's an elemental creature type. It's a 3/2 body. It has flying and landfall. Whenever land enters the battlefield under your control, you may gain control of target creature for as long as you control Royal Elemental. So it's basically a steal everything play for you if Yarik is on board. And if he's not on board, then you're still going to be able to steal a bunch of things. I'm not a big steal your stuff person, but in this deck, we're so focused so much on the land drops and the land value that comes with it, that if we want to do a big swing for the win, being able to kind of clear the way a little bit by stealing some incremental creatures or the death touch creatures so we can swing with something big or anything like that. I mean, it really, it helps to make, ensure that we can kind of deliver that final blow to our opponents here. We have Tatiova in here. Tatiova is probably becoming the landfall staple, if I were to say. She's not a staple in every deck, but she is a landfall staple as it's defined right now. So Tatiova is 3 and Simic, or green-blue. Whenever a land enters the battlefield under your control, you can gain 1 life and draw a card. So she doesn't say landfall specifically on her, but whenever a text says whenever a land enters the battlefield, that's a landfall trigger, basically. By definition of landfall, that's really what it's looking for. So Tatiova is a fantastic landfall creature. Gains you life, draws you cards. It gives you kind of that card advantage and that life point advantage to power you through that end game or recover you in the mid game, more or less. We also run Seedborn Muse to untap everything so you can kind of get extra turns out of, you know, your opponent's turns. We are running blue and black, which have a lot of nice instant speed interactions. Green, not so much. Green is more sorcery based and more big stompy combat creature centric designs, which do a lot of things on your turn, not so much other people's turns. So Seedborn Muse is really there to capitalize on that blue and that black mana that we do have in those blue and black interactions in the deck. Speaking of black interactions, we do have Obnixilus the Fallen. So Obnixilus is 3 black black landfall. Whenever a land enters the battlefield under your control, you may have target player lose 3 life. It's target player. So if there for some reason you need to lose 3 life or you need to be under a certain amount or anything like that, you can ping yourself if need be, but I would say 98% of the time you're pinging an opponent. And if you do, put 3 +1/+1 counters onto Obnixilus the Fallen. Obnixilus comes out, he's a 3/3 body. With 1 land drop, he becomes a 6/6 body. I mean, and you're playing your land for turn anyway. So this is basically 5 mana for a 6/6 that deals 3 damage to an opponent when you play a land. It's an amazing card, and it fits in really good with this deck. Now, remember that all of these landfall triggers are going to trigger twice if Yarik is on board. So a lot of the creatures, we put them in here because their value, even triggering once, is really powerful. But if Yarik is on board, or we can throw the Panharmonicon out there, the value that you get off of these landfall creatures is just phenomenal. It's top tier value. There isn't a landfall deck that is a CEDH brew, because landfall by nature is kind of limited to your ramp. But landfall in an optimized or focused group, or even a casual group, is an extremely powerful effect and gets a lot of oohs and ahs, and it has a lot of fun to be played with it. So continuing down the list here, we have things like World Shaper and some other stuff to get a whole bunch of lands out of the graveyard. So when we sack all of our lands to, say, our Scapeshift play, right? Scapeshift is going to kind of be one of your win cons in this deck. Scapeshift, you are going to... let me read it out to you. So Scapeshift says, it's 2 green-green. Sacrifice any number of lands. Search your library for up to that many land cards and put them onto the battlefield tapped. Then shuffle your library. So we play Scapeshift. We go get a boatload of lands. They come onto the battlefield. Say we sack 10 lands. We put 10 lands out on the battlefield. It's going to trigger all of our landfall creatures 10 times. But we have all those 10 lands in our graveyard. Well, if we play World Shaper, World Shaper says whenever World Shaper attacks, you may put the top 3 cards of your library into your graveyard. Not really why he's here. But when World Shaper dies, put all land cards from your graveyard onto the battlefield tapped. So it gets us all of those land cards back out onto the battlefield to, again, trigger all of those landfall effects. We're all about trying to capitalize on those opportunities to really make sure that they, you know, we get value out of every single land drop. We also run Lotus Cobra in this deck, and Lotus Cobra is kind of it's a weird one. The value for landfall on Lotus Cobra is it gives you one mana of any color whenever a land enters the battlefield. Which is fantastic because it's pseudo-ramp and it's not pseudo-ramp, it is ramp. But it's not permanent ramp, right? It doesn't give you those lands. But if Yarik is on board, he's going to give you 2 mana of any color. That turns your Evolving Wilds into a 2 mana gaining kind of land drop. That's an amazing value engine. It just works really, really well in this deck. I would keep it in here. That's just the way that it goes. We also run a little bit of hate. So one of the things that we were kind of about, we were on the shelf about, was making sure that we hit all these landfall interactions, which are allowed on creatures, but not so much artifacts. So we're a little bit artifact light. So we decided to put Collector Oofy in here. Collector Oofy says activated abilities of artifacts can't be activated. So it just cuts off everyone else's mana rocks as well as yours, but you don't run that many because you are ramping really hard with all of your ramp cards and, you know, getting all those value engines active and having everything online. What else for creatures here? So we have Disciple of Bolas. This was one that was a little weird with the stack, but worked out really well. When Disciple of Bolas enters the battlefield, sacrifice another creature. You gain X life and draw X cards, where X is that creature's power. So when he enters the battlefield, he's going to trigger twice. When he triggers twice, you're going to sacrifice 2 creatures. Then you're going to gain life off of both of those creatures and draw cards off of both of those triggers. Again, phenomenal value. Even if you sack one of your plant tokens, which may very well be at minimum a 3-3, if not a 4-4 or higher, you could sacrifice 2 of them, draw 8 cards, gain 8 life. I mean, that's just amazing in and of itself for design value. We're going to look through a couple of the sorceries here. So we do have a land ramp package. On Deck Design MTG, I like to refer to things as a package. So a subset of cards that kind of is standardized across all of EDH, but then you can kind of shift and move the levers around for whatever deck you're coming onto. So we have a draw package, we have a ramp package, we've got a counterspell package, you've got a burn package. You know, there's forever names of packages that are out there. And for this deck, what you really want is you need a strong counterspell package, a decent draw package, and a high-quality ramp package. The ramp package that we have right now in the deck is kind of your standard ramp package. Comes complete with things like Cultivate, Kadama's Reach, your Rampant Growths, your Sky Shroud Claims, stuff like that. To go and dig you out those lands, right? Put one on the battlefield, put one in your hand. Sky Shroud Claim is put them on the battlefield, both of them on the battlefield. Explosive Veggies, we got that in there. Rampant Growth is just go get a land, put it on the battlefield tapped. Those are really powerful cards for this deck in terms of how we want to trigger our landfalls. Because they get value outside of what they're doing for you already. They trigger all those landfall creatures again. Even if you have one or two on board, you're still getting a huge amount of value just from it being landfall. We got a couple of draw package cards in our sorceries here. So we have things like Splendid Reclamation. Excuse me, not Splendid Reclamation. Shamanic Revelation. It's close. We'll draw a card for each creature you control. And then if you have Ferocious, you gain 4 life for each creature you control with power 4 or greater. So if you control a couple creatures that are power 4 or greater, you will gain 4 life per creature, which is good. It's not why it's in here, but it's good. This is a token brew as much as it is a landfall value brew. So with that being said, when we get those tokens out there, we want to make sure that we can capitalize on them. And if we have a bunch of tokens, Shamanic Revelation says we draw cards for each creature we control. If we control 12 creatures, I'm drawing 12 cards. That's amazing value for that. Rich Cards Expertise, another draw package for this. We're going to draw cards equal to the greatest power among creatures you control. You can cast cards with converted mana cost 5 or less from your hand without paying its mana cost. You may cast one card from your hand with a converted mana cost 5 or greater without paying its mana cost. 5 or greater? 5 or less without paying its mana cost. Excuse me. We also run Harmonize. Harmonize is just decent value just in and of itself. We can make some swaps in here. The list is not finalized. Any EDH player or any EDH brewer knows that your deck is constantly evolving. It's constantly growing and shifting and shuffling from what, you know, you want to put in there. So Tishano was a one that we may put in here as well. It's a merfolk that enables you to draw a ton of cards when they enter the battlefield. They have just a huge... It's an ability to draw a ton of cards all at once, which seems to be the kind of effects that we have built into the deck. Let's go over some of the instants. So continuing with the draw package in instants, we wanted to be able to draw some cards, and Black has some really interesting cards that say draw 2 cards, sacrifice a creature, draw 2 cards. Sacrifice 2 creatures, draw 3 cards. Again, token deck will have the bodies on board so that we can go out and we can draw those cards. We can sacrifice the creatures and kind of get that value right out of the gate off of those black cards. Our counterspell package is really built into the instance because that's what makes sense. A counterspell at sorcery speed is kind of dumb. So with our counterspell package, we have things like Arcane Denial, Counterspell, Disallow, Mana Drain, Memory Lapse, Negate, Pact of Negation. These things are all in there so that you can make sure that your key power plays resolve, right? And they stay protected. If Yarik is on board, you want to make sure he's protected. You don't want to let somebody swords him or you know, destroy target creature, anything like that. You want to make sure that you know, you're going to maintain that value engine as you continue down the road. That's important. You also want to be able to counter spells if they're coming after you and trying to make sure that Scapeshift doesn't resolve or anything like that. These are all really important things to make sure that you're keeping an eye on and making sure that you really focus on what is valuable enough to counter. Because in any EDH deck, we need to decide whether or not whatever the opponent played against us is something to counter. If it's not something that is going to impact your overall win strategy, it may hurt you to lose your creatures or take a little bit of life or discard some cards or, you know, sacrifice a creature. But if it doesn't blow out your win con, it may be better to let the thing resolve and hold that counterspell so that when you go to cast your Scapeshift or when you go to cast your Obnixilis or, you know, get, you know, cast your Crucible of Worlds or anything like that to get that value, you could protect that thing so it resolves. So what a lot of newer players don't understand is the power of blue in that regard. It's not because it's just this infinite, powerful genie that, you know, is all-knowing. It's the ability to ensure that what you're trying to do resolves. We're all trying to do these big, splashy, wonderful things or, you know, set up these machines and these combinations. All it takes is one counterspell and you can throw an entire system out of whack. And that's the beauty of you having counterspells or holding them up to counter something to mess up somebody else's value engine. The blue cannot be stated enough that it really is just a powerhouse color. Looking more at the decks here, we ran Veil of Summer. This card is just bananas, but it's kind of a powerhouse play for this deck. Veil of Summer is one green. It's an instant speed card. It's a draw card if an opponent has cast a blue or black spell this turn. In EDH, blue and black are both not only the most powerful colors, but also some, I would venture to say, the most popular colors to play. Green is really good for beginning, but blue, once you get a hang of playing blue, it's very hard to not play blue. You get very comfortable drawing cards consistently and doing these things. So there's a good chance that there's a blue spell being played somewhere. Now, granted, you want to play this on your turn because the rest of the card is important. So, spells you control can't be countered this turn. You and permanents you control gain hexproof from blue and from black until the end of turn. Most importantly here, your spells can't be countered. Now, that's not to say that the opponent can't interrupt your combination by, say, destroying your creature or destroying your artifact or interacting with your board. Interaction, a good deck interacts with other decks or protects itself from those interactions in some way, shape, or form. This card enables you to play your Scapeshift, play your Obnixilis, play any card on your turn, and they're uncounterable, which means they're going to resolve. Whatever's on the board is still at risk a little bit, but most times the blue player is going to kind of look at you and be a little distraught because they want to counter those big splashy things. You know, you put 10 mana into something, they want to counter it with that mana drain, but with this card, after they play it, they can't do it. So they got to hold it to counter this spell, or else your entire rest of your turn, you're free to do whatever you want. Veil of Summer is a great card. I'm really looking forward to getting it off there and doing it there. So another card that does that same thing is Bound and Determined. So Determined is green and blue. Other spells you control can't be countered by spells or ability this turn. Draw a card. And then Bound is three black green. Sacrifice a creature. Return up to X cards from your graveyard to your hand, where X is the number of colors that creature was. Then remove this card from the game. We don't really play this card for Bound. We play it for Determined. So Determined says, again, that none of our spells can be countered. That one can, but if that one resolves, no other spells can be countered. That's a huge effect, and it's awesome. We also run Psych Rift, just in the off chance that we're having some problems. Artifacts for the deck. We're only running two, maybe three. We might be doing some swaps here. But the two that we have in here are Crucible of Worlds and Sol Ring. I firmly believe, and I will stand behind it, that Sol Ring is the only staple of EDH. Sol Ring is the only card that really has a home in every single EDH deck, from jank kitchen table brews to straight competitive turn three win con brews. Sol Ring is the only card that finds a house in all of the things in the middle. I believe it's a staple. I believe that can be the only one that's defined as that. The rest of them, there's always places to slot other options in and do different things. So we're doing that. And we're also running Crucible Worlds. Like I said, we're definitely trying to have some of those graveyard land recursion interactions, because we do want to get that extra utility out of the lands to, you know, get that big scape shift off, or to ensure that if we don't have lands in our hands, we can play those fetches from our graveyard or anything like that to make sure that we're really capitalizing on having them. All right, so we're getting into the enchantments now. So our enchantments, this is where it really kind of churns a lot of value. The enchantments, we're running 11 enchantments in the deck right now. And they are as follows. So we have Doubling Season. Doubling Season is in here for the obvious value of doubling all of our counters, doubling all of our tokens that come into play. It's just a huge gain card. When Doubling Season hits the table, you definitely get those oohs and ahs from your opponents, because they know that, you know, they kind of cracked your strategy a little bit, but they also know they can't do too much about it immediately. So Doubling Season is just awesome to be in whatever deck it's in. Exploration is going to be there to hit those extra land drops. Growing Rites of Itlamok is a fantastic card, especially in combination with Avenger. So Avenger is going to hit the battlefield, make you a whole bunch of tokens, and then you play Growing Rites of Itlamok. It'll flip over into a Gaia's Cradle. Now, Gaia's Cradle is a land, it's a legendary land, attached for one green mana, or its effect can be tapped to add green mana for each creature you control. In this deck, we're making a bunch of tokens. It's not a 100% go wide. It is a lot of value that comes off of this thing. So you're going to be able to capitalize to use this card to gain a lot of green mana once Avenger and a couple other different cards hit the table. But having a Gaia's Cradle is never a bad thing. We're running Imprisoned in the Moon. If you are playing against somebody who has a creature that is recurrable, or say you just don't want their commander out on the battlefield at all, but you can't put it back in the command zone because they can recast it, and they can, you know, do all kinds of interactions that way. Imprisoned in the Moon is a card that turns their commander or whatever permanent into a land that taps for colorless mana. That's it. It is a blue... what is the... There's a green one, and I play against it all the time. Song of the Dryads. So it's a blue Song of the Dryads, where it just turns that card into a land, and that's it. It doesn't really do anything else. So, we have Miri's Guile, which is a really interesting card that I didn't actually know existed. One of the people in the chat actually threw it out there, and I was like, wow, that's awesome. So it is a one mana. During your upkeep, you may look at the top three cards of your library and put them back in any order. So a Sylvan Library is a card that's also in the deck. It costs two mana to draw two additional cards, and then you can pay four life and keep them for, you know, pay four life per card and keep it, or put two back and you're good. Well, what Mirror's Guile enables you to do is kind of a Sylvan Library effect. It enables you to kind of stack your turn, right? You can dig three cards deep every turn to see which one you want to draw, rather than trying to figure out, like, oh, well, I really want this card. Do I want to pay four life for it? You know, so on and so forth. So it enables you to just make sure that you're hitting those cards that you want when you need to hit them. It's an awesome card and a great suggestion by the people in the chat. We're also running Parallel Lives. It's another token doubler. It's a great card. We have Rhystic Study in here. the most annoying card in EDH, but you know what? It is probably one of the most consistent draw engines in EDH. I say consistent draw engine because anybody who runs Rhystic Study, you're going to draw cards off of it, and most times you're going to draw more than what 3 mana would allot you in a lot of other colors. 3 mana in most colors is going to draw you 2 cards. Rhystic Study, I would say 9 times out of 10, prior to it being removed in some way, shape, or form, is going to draw you at least 3 cards, if not 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, all the way up. I've seen Rhystic Study draw people half a library at times just simply because we've, you know, been locked out of a game or something like that. So Rhystic Study is just a very consistently powerful draw engine piece. Song of the Dryads is in this deck. We have a card in here also called Squandered Resources. So Squandered Resources enables us to hit our land drops in the off chance that we have every land out on the battlefield. We can sacrifice a land, add to your mana pool 1 mana of any type the sacrificed land could produce, play this ability as a mana source. So we can sacrifice lands to add mana to our mana pool and then play them out of our graveyard. If Crucible is out here, it turns Strip Mine into like this very angry mana source. It enables us to kind of sack those lands, especially if we have 40 lands in here and we have all 40 of them out on the battlefield. It enables us to kind of say, okay, well, I have no more in my deck, so I'm going to sack this one, and then I'll play it for my turn. And I'll sack it, and I'll play it for my turn, back and forth and back and forth. And you get just a ton of value out of it. Not to mention that you can sack tapped lands. So you can tap the land for mana, sack that land, add the mana to your mana pool from Squandered Resources, then play the land back out of your graveyard with one of your graveyard recursions, tap it again, get some more. So you're getting 4 mana basically out of your lands, regardless of what's happening. And then you're also triggering your landfall creatures more and more to make sure that you're getting all those values out of it. Great card, great suggestion from the chat as we were going through it. We're also running Zendikar's Royal. So Zendikar's Royal is an actual landfall create 2/2s. So whenever a land enters the battlefield under my control, I'm going to create a 2/2 elemental creature. We run Rampaging Baloth, which gives us 4/4 elemental creatures when lands hit the battlefield. We have Avenger that makes plant tokens when it hits the battlefield. And again, all this stuff is going to trigger several times in order to really capitalize on those land drops. So those are our enchantments. And again, everything is kind of synergized together to make sure that every time we play a land, not only are we getting the mana off the land, but we're making sure that we trigger all of those landfall effects as it hits the battlefield. We want to make sure that, okay, I play this land, I'm not just getting the mana off of it, but maybe I'm getting 2 mana off of it because of Lotus Cobra. And maybe I'm making a 4/4 beast and a 2/2 elemental. And maybe I'm lightning bolting somebody in the face and getting, you know, bumping up Obnixilus to a 12/12 at this point. Or maybe I'm stealing somebody's stuff alongside of that. Getting into the lands a little bit, we do run Field of the Dead here. And a bunch of lands that have their, you know, their own unique name because it's EDH and we can't run multiples of the same thing. So maybe we play a land drop and Field of the Dead's going to trigger twice. You know, we hit those Scapeshift. Scapeshift Field of the Dead is like a huge combination currently in standard metas. I wouldn't say it's a tier 1 deck as much as it was. It kind of hit the ground running. And then once people kind of understood what was happening, people have created a couple answers to it. And it's not as hyper powerful as it was. It's still extremely powerful, but it's not as consistently winning as what it used to do. But again, all those things are going to happen, and they're going to happen twice if Yarrick is out on the battlefield. So we really want to focus in on making sure that our board is set up appropriately. So let's go over some of the utility lands, and then we'll close out with kind of an overarching summary of what Yarrick really wants to do here and how we're going to deliver that. So we run almost, I would say, not every, but probably 6 or 7 of the fetch lands. Any of the fetch lands that enables us to get any color of our lands, is going to be in the deck. So actually, that might be 9 of them. 9 of the 10 fetch lands. I think the only one that's not in here is maybe the Scalding Tarn. I think that's the fetch land. The red-white one. So we run all of them in here. We got Bajuka Bog. We have Cabal Carfers and Urborg in here. Evolving Wilds to go get us to kind of mana fix us if we're having problems. Field of the Dead, Mortuary Mire. Mortuary Mire enables us to put a creature from our graveyard on top of our battlefield, or excuse me, on top of our library. Volrath Stronghold also enables us to do the same thing, but we don't have to sacrifice it. We pay a black and one colorless to put target creature from your graveyard on top of your library. That's just awesome value. If you lost something in the fray, you know, you might be able to recur it out of your graveyard using these lands, which is something that's usually pretty protected when we talk about EDH games. We're also running a Blighted Woodland and Myriad Landscape. There's a couple of these cards in here where we can put a little bit of mana into it, sacrifice it, and then go get some lands and put them out on the battlefield. Just to trigger those landfall effects again and to kind of mana fix us if we're having any kinds of issues. Then we run a Prismatic Vista to go, again, go get the proper land that we need if need be. If not, it taps for mana, so we're good. We're running 3 Swamps, 5 Islands, and 10 Forests. This is very much a blue-green deck with a splash of black. So that's kind of what the mana base looks like. So that's the deck. Again, it's called Yarrick Land Explosions, and it's on moxfield.com. The deck itself, you can run on there. You can kind of comment on the brew itself if you have any questions. So what do we want to do with this deck? How do we play this deck? So this deck really doesn't... It's not a dirtle deck at all, but what it does want to do is it wants to ramp really hard, probably your first 3 or 4 turns. You want to get Yarrick out by maybe turn 5 at the latest. There's no reason why with Exploration and all of your ramp package and some of your cards that enable you to play multiple lands per turn, that you shouldn't be able to have Yarrick on board by turn 4 fairly consistently. If you're playing against a hyper aggro or a big removal meta, you may want to hold back Yarrick a little bit and kind of set up your board for one big splashy turn and hold up those counter spells. A lot of metas, there's always that one player that has like 87 removal spells and their entire life is just focused on zapping and hitting everything that is your creatures and making sure the board just never ever develops for anyone. If that is the kind of person, a great spell or two for them is Determined or Veil of Summer, right? So at that point, once you cast one of those two spells, all of your other spells can't be countered. So that person can just live their life. You can kind of develop out your board as much as you want. And then when those removal spells hit, you're still going to kind of get enough value that you'll out-attrition them when it gets to the mid and the late game. When we get into our tokens, if there's two different directions here, right? So we held Yarrick off a little bit. We're kind of developing out the board. Then we put Yarrick on the board. And then we drop a whole bunch of lands to trigger a bunch of things. Or we have Yarrick on board. Then we kind of play things controllably, right? So if we need tokens, we're going to play Avenger. Or we're going to play Rampaging Baloth. And then we're going to play our lands. And we're going to double up those tokens that we get out of it. There's two different directions to take it. One is if you need to control kind of the early aggression. The other one is if you are going to be the aggressor and have control over how the game's going to go. If you're in control and want to dictate how the game's going to kind of swing back and forth, now you're not going to be able to do it the whole time because it is EDH. EDH games can swing from player to player to player very consistently. But if that's the kind of setup that you're going for, that's when you play Yarrick on turn 4. you're going to play Obnixilis or Rampaging Baloth or you know, a Wood Elves or something on turn five. Maybe double up on a couple of those creatures that have those powerful ETBs. Throw them down. Develop out your board how you'd like. Hold up a couple counter spells to make sure that nobody's really going to interfere. And try to just overrun the board in just pure value to come out of your engine, right? Once they see Yarik and his interactions with your cards the first time, they're going to know what's going to happen, and they're going to try to remove him. Because Yarik is the reason why all of your other cards are as insanely good as they are. If somebody has a removal spell and you have Yarik, Rampaging Baloths, Avenger, and Azusa on board, or any creature, they're going to look at the value engine first to see which card to remove. If you have all those cards on board, there's a better than not chance that you're going to end up winning a game anyway. But what makes Avenger able to put two counters on every plant token you have? What makes Baloth, Rampaging Baloth, have the ability to create two tokens every time you play a land? You know, what makes Obnixilis able to bolt somebody in the face for six and put six counters on him? Yarik does that. So Yarik is going to be the thing that gets removed more often than not right out of the rip. And then they're going to focus on picking apart the rest of your board. So you need to be able to protect him if you're going to play with that, I'm going to control the pace, I'm going to be the aggressor kind of strategy. If you're playing the other side of it, where you're going to kind of get some landfall creatures out there, and then when you're going to have that one splashy turn that wins the game, that is a different strategy. You're going to want to hold up a lot of counter spells. You're going to want to hold up a lot of those value pieces towards the end. You know, you want to put your Baloth into play and then get a bunch of value off it. You know, bait out those removal spells. You know, I want to get Avenger out there and make me a bunch of blockers and try to get something going there. Now, you don't want to play all of your engine, because if you play all of your landfall pieces and then get Yarik out, well, if somebody destroys most of your boards, you're going to get nowhere near the value that you would have gotten if you kind of out-tempoed them. Tempo is a huge portion of what makes Magic magic. And with this deck, you're going to get a lot of value really quickly. People are going to notice that, and they're going to immediately start trying to interrupt that tempo. They're going to try to remove this creature and that one and this one. And then what you don't want to happen is you're running 26 creatures in your deck. You don't want it to come around where you finally get Yarik on board and, you know, 17 of your creatures are in the graveyard, and only one or two of them have landfall that are left, and the rest of them are just nonchalant and unhelpful. So you have to be able to time it appropriately to really hit that one turn big swing. So you need your counter spells. You need to make sure that you're doing your graveyard and doing some of that work to set that big turn up. And other than that, I mean, that's how we really want to play Yarik. We want to make sure that we're picking one of those two directions, however you want to do it, and you want to make sure that you're consistently prepared to use that counterspell package to defend kind of your win con, you know? Then there's two in the deck. There's the Scapeshift win con, where we're getting maximum value out of those landfall creatures to outvalue everyone, overrun them. And then there's also kind of the card draw engine out attrition win con. It's not based on one card, it's just slower version of the original wincon. It kind of just kind of corners you into making it easy to play. Yarik is a deck that is not very complicated to play, but can do a lot of really wild things. So spoiler for Thursday. We are going to start our Color Wheel Challenge. Our Color Wheel Challenge is we're going to brew a deck for every color or combination of colors in Magic. That is 32 decks, including colorless. And this Thursday, we're going to start off with red. I've run polls on Facebook. I've run polls on Reddit. just to reach out to everybody. I'm a man of the people, and I want to do what the people want to do. So what we've ended up resulting with is we're going to brew. Most likely, there's about a 98.999% chance that it's going to be Norn the Wary. So Norn the Wary is a mono red creature that whenever a player casts a spell, you're going to remove him from the game. And then on the end step, he's going to come back into the battlefield. So it's going to be an ETB, type deck brew in mono red. So how are we going to answer some of the big power questions that are in mono red, right? How do we deal with the mana issues that come with playing red? We're not playing burn, so like, how do we, you know, make sure that we do, you know, handle that portion of it? You know, where's all that incremental value going to come from? And, you know, what are the cards that we're going to put in the deck to give us all those big swingy turns that do all those amazing things? We're going to do all that on Thursday. Again, the show's called Twitch. It's not called Twitch. It's on twitch.tv/deckdesignmtg. And again, it's purely the deck brewing show just to teach people how to deck brew. We're going to brew Norn the Wary. I would love to see you guys in the chat. I know that you guys have awesome opinions and awesome ideas for what cards could go in the decks and kind of how to play the decks. I think that, you know, as a group, I'm good at brewing and I'm very confident with my brews. But with the Yarrick deck, you guys heard me say this was a suggestion from, you know, one of the people in chat. One of the people in the chat suggested Squandered Resources. Somebody in the chat suggested, you know, our Tatiovas and our World Shaper and that kind of graveyard interactions with our landfalls. I mean, your suggestions are valuable in the chat, and it's a debate to have, and that's why we do what we do, is to kind of teach newer players, yourself included, why the suggestion is a good one, why it's a bad one, why it fits, why it's great. And then once the deck is complete, we'll do another episode like this on next Wednesday. It'll be released next Wednesday, and we'll go over kind of how the brew worked, how it played, how, you know, what are the win conditions, what direction did we take it in, what are all the value cards, and fixate on all of those things. So I really look forward to growing this this whole adventure with you guys. Twitch.tv/deckdesignmtg is it. The podcast here, we're going to do an episode every week, if not twice a week, just kind of going over, you know, what we love to do with Magic. And then all of the videos will be posted up on YouTube as well, with cute little thumbnails and exactly taken from the stream. That way people that, you know, we were brewing with a person from Sweden last time. It was 2 a.m. in the morning where he was from. And I don't want to keep doing that to the guy every week, but I do want him to be there and play a part. So that's why we do the YouTube channel, so that everybody can play a role. Everybody can comment and help brew and teach us some of these really cool, splashy effects overall once we get to the end there. So I hope you guys have learned something today. I hope that this has been fun for you. I really look forward to seeing you guys in the chat for Norn the Wary on Thursday. And look forward to another deck design podcast next week. Yeah, if you guys have any questions or anything like that, fire it off over in the Discord. You can put them on the YouTube channel. We do have a webpage, it's deckdesignmtg.com. Go visit it. All of our social media is on there. And I just parked my car. I'm going to get out and go see my kids and my wonderful wife. And I'm going to start doing some work for you guys. So much love to both of yous. All of yous. Everybody have a great day. Play Magic. Learn Magic. Live magically. Love you. Bye.